Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thanks so much, Rob, and I too would like to welcome everyone to the Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, updates from the 47th Annual San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, SABCS, and this is part one of Living with Breast Cancer. And I want to tell you a few things about the program. Also, this activity is supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb, an educational grant from Daiichi Sankyo, and a grant from Genentech, and I really want to thank them for their support to this program. Now, I also would like to identify who you are on the program. So we have 202 participants on the call today. You come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, Germany, the Philippines, Saudi Arabia, Uganda, and the United Kingdom. So it's really a global call. And it's a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us and learning all about updates from the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Kamel Abu Hussein. Dr. Hussein is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Cooper Medical School of Rowan University, Adjunct Assistant Professor, Department of Breast Medical Oncology, MD Anderson Cancer Center, Co-Director of the Janet Knowles Breast Cancer Program, Director of Breast Cancer Clinical Trials, MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper. And Dr. Hussein will be addressing an overview of breast cancer, new research presented at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, breast cancer specific treatment updates from the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, early stage breast cancer updates from the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, genomics of breast cancer, and genetics of breast cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Hussein.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction, Dr. Messner. This year's San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium was full of a lot of exciting and new data, and it was really hard to focus on just a few abstracts. But I'll try to touch on things that are more relevant to early-stage breast cancer and things that are more relevant clinically. So the first one that I would like to discuss is one that looked at patients who are young with BRCA mutation and breast cancer, and basically looked at patients who are 40 years or younger with breast cancer who have the BRCA gene mutation, who underwent risk-reducing mastectomy and or risk-reducing salpingo-oophorectomy. And here, this study has shown that there is a higher rate of an improvement in overall survival and disease-free survival when those surgeries are performed. So they looked at patients from 33 countries. They included more than 5,000 patients. And at the end, as I mentioned, they said that patients who underwent risk-reducing mastectomy and risk-reducing salpingo-oophorectomy, which is removal of the tubes and the ovaries, that was associated with improvement in overall survival, in disease-free survival, in breast cancer-free interval. But that applies only to that setting. And those findings may help us in improving the counseling that we offer our cancer risk young patients with for the BRCA carriers with young breast cancer. But definitely it should not be reflected on all patients who are healthy with BRCA carrier status or patients who are older with BRCA carrier and breast cancer. The second study was the Olympia study, and that was a phase three study that previously has shown us that the addition of olaparib, 1 year of olaparib, as an adjuvant therapy or postoperative therapy for patients who harbor the germline BRCA1 or BRCA2 pathogenic variants and have high-risk stage 2 or stage 3 HER2-negative breast cancer showed a significant benefit. And that study included about more than 1,800 patients who, after completing their standard treatments, which included surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation, were either randomized to receiving 1 year of olaparib or placebo. And after a follow-up that lasted more than 6 years, the olaparib has shown that it has reduced risk of death by 28% and also reduced risk of invasive breast cancer recurrence and the risk of distant disease recurrence by 35 years compared to placebo. And the consistent benefits of olaparib observed across the subgroups, including patients, of course, who have high-risk hormone receptor-positive breast cancer and triple-negative disease, highlights the importance of genetic testing at the time of diagnosis to identify those who may benefit from the treatment as early as possible. Now, shifting gears and talking more about triple-negative breast cancer, we are, or most of us are aware of a regimen that includes chemotherapy and immunotherapy, an agent called pembrolizumab or Keytruda, in addition to four-drug chemotherapy regimen, according to a clinical trial called the KEYNOTE-522. That was a phase 3 randomized trial that has shown previously that there is an improvement in the overall outcome when we treat our high-risk triple-negative patients, stage 2 or stage 3, with such a combination, with an improvement in the chances of completely eliminating the cancer from the breast and the lymph nodes, and an improvement in overall survival. Now, they presented this exploratory biomarker analysis, and that biomarker analysis had endpoints of trying to identify what is the essence of having a high tumor mutational burden, which refers to measuring the number of mutations in a tumor's DNA, and another marker called T-cell inflamed 18 gene expression profile on the overall outcome. And they showed that having a high tumor mutational burden, which was assessed by an assay called whole exome sequencing, or the T-cell inflamed gene expression profile, which we do something called RNA sequencing in research to identify, they showed that having this high high-risk early-stage triple-negative breast cancer that harbors the T-cell inflamed 18 gene expression profile leads to patients experiencing more success in eliminating the cancer cells and improving the event-free survival from the treatment overall. And they showed that having a high tumor mutational burden correlated also with an improvement in this event-free survival, which is a measurement of how long a patient is free of a certain complication after cancer treatment. Now, why is this important? Now, it is considered a valuable piece of information that helps us understand some unique features and biomarkers of tumors that would hopefully help us in the near future tailor therapy or expose patients to certain drugs because of a known benefit rather than offering everyone the same regimen of a combination of immunotherapy and four chemotherapy drugs, like the KEYNOTE-522 regimen. So that's a step in the right direction for sure. The next study is a study that looked at a new molecule. It's one of the antibody-drug conjugates, and we've talked about those in prior workshops, but the design of an antibody-drug conjugate is basically identifying a marker on the surface of the cancer cell, designing an antibody that is against that marker, and linking that antibody to a chemotherapy molecule so that once that antibody identifies the marker, it throws this chemotherapy molecule inside the cancer cell, leading to killing the cancer cell from within. Now, this antibody-drug conjugate is called patritumab deruxtecan, which is an antibody-drug conjugate against the HER3 marker, and that has previously shown biologic evidence of having anti-tumor activity. It can also drop the proliferation index called Ki-67 that we typically measure in breast cancer biopsies, and it can lead to a decrease in risk of recurrence. Now, we typically would offer patients multi-agent chemotherapy to boost the survival outcomes for the high-risk early-stage hormone receptor-positive breast cancer. But there is an intense or an immense need in giving patients that kind of benefit and creating a treatment regimen that is well-tolerated. So this molecule is considered the first in its class, and it is a HER3-directed antibody-drug conjugate, as I mentioned, and it has demonstrated activity in several subtypes of breast cancer. Previously, we saw that a single dose of that agent showed to be effective in a window of opportunity early phase 1 trial called the Solpitot HER3 study, and based on those observations, the investigators hypothesized that this agent, patritumab deruxtecan monotherapy, or in combination with one of the endocrine therapies that we commonly use, letrozole, would be a safe and effective neoadjuvant option, so before surgery, for treatment-naive patients with high-risk hormone receptor-positive early-stage breast cancer. And the name of this phase 2 trial was called the Salty Valentine trial, which sought to enroll about 120 patients who are pre- and postmenopausal with a cancer that is 1 centimeter or larger. And to be eligible, those patients needed to be hormone receptor positive and HER2 negative with a high proliferation index or a high genomic risk. So typically the group that we would normally offer chemotherapy to. They took those patients and they split them in 3 different groups. One group was treated with antibody drug conjugate, patritumab deruxtecan, given every 3 weeks for 6 cycles. The second group received the drug every 3 weeks, also for 6 cycles, in addition with hormonal therapy, the letrozole. And the third group received our typical chemotherapy agents, a drug combination like azacitidine or docetaxel. And they found out that there is a comparable level of success in achieving this pathologic complete response and objective response in those arms, but they found more favorable treatment-related adverse events by the use of this new agent with or without the hormonal therapy compared to chemotherapy. Again, those kinds of trials are very important and patient-centric, focusing on improving treatment tolerance, decreasing adverse events, and improving the overall quality of life for our patients. Another important study has a very smart idea and a question that comes in clinic quite commonly. So we see that our elderly, lovely, mature patients, when they present with breast cancer that is hormone receptor positive, we see that surgeons sometimes have lower rate of making them to surgery right away, and they could offer them endocrine or hormonal anti-estrogen therapy to try to temporize the disease and talk to them about surgery possibly in the future if the cancer starts progressing. So, with that background in mind, investigators aimed to assess whether immediate surgery plus tamoxifen improved outcomes among elderly patients with breast cancer compared with delaying surgery until patients experienced progressive disease. And so they looked at a meta-analysis that included more than 1,000 patients with breast cancer who were above the age of 70 across 3 different clinical trials evaluating immediate surgery versus deferral of surgery, and all of that, of course, is in the absence of radiation therapy. And patients included in the analysis remained on the study for a median of 5 years. And they saw that patients who were node negative had a better outcome with surgery and tamoxifen compared to tamoxifen alone. Patients who were node positive had the same outcome. So in conclusion, one could say that in the absence of radiotherapy, we see that immediate compared with deferred surgery greatly reduces local recurrence. And this benefit in local recurrence translates into a later difference in distant recurrence and breast cancer mortality, but it's only apparent with long-term follow-up. Now, a couple of words about genetics and genomics. So, for our metastatic patients, and I know that my colleague, Dr. Smith, is going to talk to us about exciting new data regarding late-stage or metastatic patients, But we commonly order a test for those patients called next-generation sequencing, also known as NGS. And that is quite helpful in improving our understanding in identifying any targetable mutations which could be used to change treatment and tailor it for every patient based on what the test shows. And this could be performed on a tissue biopsy, or it could be performed on blood sample, known as a liquid biopsy. And some of those targets have drugs that are FDA approved, things like PIK3CA, AKT1, P10, ESR1, PDL1, NTRK. Those are all identifiable markers and targets that do have drugs that work very well to address them. And genetic testing for breast cancer patients is indicated for patients who are diagnosed at a young age or patients who have a relevant family history or a personal history of cancer. Also, in certain ethnicities, it is recommended more than the average population. And all patients with triple negative breast cancer should get genetic testing. We do have drugs called the PARP inhibitors, including drugs like olaparib or talazoparib, which could be very effective in patients who harbor some mutations like BRCA1, BRCA2, or PALB2 mutations. At this point, I want to be respectful of the time, and I want to thank you for your attention, and I will pass it back to you, Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Hussain. That was just a stellar presentation, just wonderful, and I covered a lot of areas, which I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Wade Smith, and Dr. Smith is breast cancer specialist, assistant clinical professor, Department of Medical Oncology and Therapeutics Research, City of Hope. And Dr. Smith will be addressing younger and older people living with breast cancer, new treatment approaches for metastatic breast cancer from the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, preventing and managing treatment side effects, discomfort, and pain, clinical trial updates from the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, key questions to ask your healthcare team, and guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, quality of life concerns, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Smith.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. I'm happy to be joining this program with these excellent speakers. And again, I wanted to give an overview of the recent San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium and kind of how it applies to my practice, our practice here. And I'll just kind of jump right into it. So essentially, you know, at this conference, we see hundreds of abstracts presented, and I'll try to incorporate that all into kind of what my takeaway is with respect to the first topic, younger and older people living with breast cancer. And I will say that in my own practice, I incorporate a clinical social worker often to address the psychosocial needs of patients because they have very different needs based on age and demographics. So, for instance, younger patients, you know, fertility obviously needs to be addressed at the first consultation, especially if they're going to undergo chemotherapy. And I will readdress fertility, you know, ongoing. Just to, you know, patients sometimes are kind of a deer in the headlights. They're seen with a new diagnosis. They really just want to kind of, you know, get the cancer out, you know, get on with treatment, and they may not really take to heart, you know, other concerns with regard to family planning. So I readdress that as we go on in treatment. And likewise, there have been many studies that show that we can incorporate or at least we can reassure patients that proceeding with pregnancy, even within a couple to a few years out from their breast cancer diagnosis, can be safe. And so there are some studies that support that. So I address that in younger patients. Patients that are younger often have concurrent family responsibilities, children they're caring for, stress on the part of a spouse. And so, again, I get the clinical social worker involved with that. They might have, you know, wanting to continue work. Work is very important for identity. And so as such, you know, I work with patients just to make sure that, you know, we can maintain a normal, you know, as much of a pre-diagnosis, pre-treatment lifestyle as possible. And, you know, older patients often have shared, you know, needs, and oftentimes, though, very different. So an older patient may be the sole provider for a spouse, the sole caretaker for a spouse. So whatever we offer them in terms of their treatment plan, it needs to be accommodating to their responsibilities at home. And they may be more limited with regard to transportation resources or other resources. They may be more financially restricted, as data shows. And likewise, we see concurrent mental health challenges and illness with a higher incidence in elderly patients than we do with younger people. So we have to incorporate all that. Older patients may also have a different value system with regard to their health, priorities, life expectancy, and so forth. So that all needs to be addressed. And they might also have adult children that are very much involved in their decision making. And so family dynamics, sometimes functional, sometimes dysfunctional, really do require added effort when dealing with our older patients in general. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about specific trials presented at San Antonio and having to do with new treatment approaches for metastatic breast cancer. And really, we have about a half dozen that really jump out that I'd like to just spend a little bit of time on. And I'll mention the name of the study so that you can look it up. It is all accessible online. There's one called the PATINA study, P-A-T-I-N-A. And the PATINA study basically is finding a, you know, looking to see if there's a new role for CDK4/6 inhibitors. So some of you are familiar with Kisqali or Verzenio. Those are the trade names for very common drugs that we use. And this is specifically looking at adding this class of agent to HER2-positive breast cancer patients, which is new. Before, these drugs were primarily restricted to HER2-negative breast cancer patients. So the PATINA study found that adding the CDK4/6 blocker, palbociclib, is essentially adding it to standard endocrine therapy along with anti-HER2 therapy in metastatic hormone receptor-positive breast cancer patients extended the patient's median progression-free survival, meaning how long they lived until the time of progression, by more than a year. So for anti-HER2 therapy, the majority of them were on trastuzumab and pertuzumab, and the majority of them were also on an aromatase inhibitor. So very common, you know, first-line therapy for HER2-positive breast cancers. And we saw, as I mentioned, a 1.3-year longer progression-free survival in those patients who were on the palbociclib, also known as Ibrance. And so this is, I think, certainly eye-opening as we carry this forward because, you know, obviously this really presents a whole new application for this line of therapy. So that's the PATINA study. There was another study called PADMA, P-A-D-M-A. And this really addresses the question, what is the best first-line therapy for, you know, high-risk metastatic breast cancer patients who are hormone receptor positive? And so it basically compared endocrine therapy plus a CDK4/6 inhibitor versus chemotherapy as the first-line treatment that a patient will receive for hormone receptor positive HER2-negative breast cancer patients. And the time to treatment failure was found to be significantly longer for those patients who received the palbociclib endocrine therapy at 17.2 months compared to chemotherapy at 6.1 months. So, you know, this is, I think, important, you know, high-risk patients. Again, this was excluding patients that maybe were lower risk, that had, you know, asymptomatic, you know, limited bone involvement. But certainly this gives us confidence that we can start patients right away with a therapy that is arguably better tolerated and feel good about it. So another trial called the SONIA trial was discussed. And the SONIA trial, again, looks at the CDK4/6 inhibitor and really doesn't matter if it's first or second line. And so by convention, we would always add a CDK4/6 inhibitor for our metastatic patients in the first line, thinking that that made a difference. But it was found that for patients who had, again, hormone receptor positive, HER2-negative breast cancer, progression-free survival, as well as the health-related quality of life, was the same whether they started it in the first or second line. And this looked at over 1,000 patients. And again, the CDK4/6 inhibitor that was used was Ibrance or palbociclib. And this really gives us some reassurance that in patients who maybe we want to avoid some of the side effects, toxicity monitoring requirements for the CDK4/6 inhibitor, we can add it to the second line and feel good about that. So again, offers a new option for patients in that first-line metastatic setting. There was another trial called the EMBER-3 trial. And so the EMBER-3 trial looks at a new class of endocrine therapy that's called a SERD, or selective estrogen receptor downregulator, and it is an oral therapy, and looking at it in the second-line space. So some of you may be familiar with elacestrant, which has earned its approval. This is another in this class. But this study showed something specific to this medication that is exciting. So for one, it did show that in the second line, this medicine called imlunestrant prolonged progression-free survival compared to standard therapy in the second-line therapy, specifically for those patients who have an ESR1 mutation. This progression-free survival did not extend to everyone, however. So those lacking the ESR1 mutation did not benefit. However, when the same oral medication was combined with another oral medication, CDK4/6 inhibitor abemaciclib or Verzenio, we found that there was a significant improvement in progression-free survival. So the importance of the EMBER-3 trial is this new class of medicine in combination with abemaciclib has been shown to be effective in the second line to the tune of 9.4 versus 5.5 months progression-free survival. So this was an important takeaway from this year's meeting. Another study, DESTINY-Breast06, looks at a class of breast cancer called HER2-low, HER2-low, and with specifically with reference to a medication we've reserved primarily or previously for HER2-positive breast cancers. So it basically looked at patients who have a HER2 of 1+ or 2+, again, HER2-low, who had progression on at least one prior endocrine therapy line in the metastatic setting, basically when treated with T-DXd, also known as Enhertu, these patients had an improved progression-free survival of 14 months compared to 6.5 months compared to provider's choice. So again, this really is an important takeaway for patients who don't have HER2-positive breast cancer, however, have what's called HER2-low, as well as HER2-ultra-low, which is a HER2 of 0. And so this is an important question to ask your oncologist, you know, am I HER2-low? Am I HER2-ultra-low? Because this can open up the option very early on in your treatment course for a drug called T-DXd or Enhertu. So there was another study, DESTINY-12, that again looked at the same drug, T-DXd and Enhertu, and found that patients really did quite well in terms of having neurologic function a year after starting it, as well as overall health-related quality of life. Cognitive, emotional, physical, social functioning really had not deteriorated. Again, I think that important takeaway is this medication is, as a whole, well-tolerated and can be dose-adjusted when necessary. But, you know, anytime you go online and you read about it, there are various reporting about, you know, how well-tolerated this is. In my own clinical experience, I found it to be, you know, very tolerable and, again, highly effective. So I now want to shift gears to really the topic of preventing and managing treatment-related side effects, discomfort, and pain. And at this year's meeting, there was a study called PRO-B, P-R-O-B. And this basically looked at the benefit of weekly reporting of, you know, side effects and so forth for patients who are on therapy compared to less frequent reporting. And it really does show that the more attentive we are to our patients, the better outcome they're going to have. So we found that the overall quality of life and prolonged, as well as the prolonged survival was evidenced. And again, by having patients report as well as having a an alert system for, you know, severe symptoms such as fatigue, that, you know, when this was actually, you know, as part of a trial, these patients had better outcomes. And it does kind of dovetail into, you know, what our current practice is. We, you know, informally, we reach out to our patients. We call them within 72 hours after a chemotherapy start day. We assess them regularly. Oftentimes, we'll bring them in for weekly nursing visits, if not, you know, hydration in our clinic. So I think the PRO-B study does show the benefit of really close monitoring patients once they've started on therapy. And so there were some other clinical trial updates, and Dr. Hussain did talk about he did talk about the study Olympia, and I will just emphasize that that is an important trial. I won't add too much to what he's already said, except this has to do with a class of medicine called PARP inhibitor for patients who are BRCA1 or BRCA2 carriers. And it really just underlies the importance of testing. So I feel very strongly that, patients who have high-risk disease, either in the hormone receptor-positive setting or triple-negative setting that are, HER2-negative, should definitely have their gene panel, expanded gene panel testing completed to see if they are carriers of the BRCA1 or BRCA2. Because we have, again, the six-year data reported on the Olympia trial that shows that patients have both a disease-free survival and a distant disease-free survival improved by 35% in each category. So this is something we don't want to miss out on. So always ask if you are one of these patients, lymph node positive disease, large primary tumor, or a tumor that didn't respond to chemotherapy prior to surgery, have I had my genes tested? Do I know my BRCA status? And so another important clinical trial update that was really an exploratory analysis had to do with what's called the TAILOR-X study that I think is just worth noting. This really looks at the test Oncotype DX. Some of you may be familiar with it. It's a test that on the tumor that looks to see what the risk is for the tumor coming back and whether there's a benefit to receiving chemotherapy after surgery. So what this exploratory analysis found was that there was actually a cutoff seen in terms of recurrence score of 31. With regard to who benefited, who seemed to benefit from an anthracycline, adriamycin, versus a non-anthracycline chemotherapy. And so, those who had a higher than 31 recurrence score by the Oncotype DX test actually demonstrated an improved distant recurrence-free survival. So we're talking about, a reduction in the risk of the cancer coming back incurable, as well as a longer distance, as well as a recurrence-free interval. So I think it's something worth noting, and it's something that I've been doing for patients who have a high Oncotype DX score, and in this case above 31, definitely consideration towards an anthracycline versus non-anthracycline regimen should be considered. And so I was also asked just to comment, and hopefully I'm not running out of time, but just to comment on, key questions to ask your healthcare team. And again, this has been supported by the multitude of abstracts that have been presented. For instance, I would start off with, what is the goal of care? What am I being treated in the curative setting or in the disease control setting? Are we expecting to cure my underlying breast cancer, or are we looking to control it? That's the number one, question to ask. I would also ask questions in terms of, am I going to receive a formal chemotherapy teaching from nursing, prior to starting chemotherapy, as well as am I going to have time to ask follow-up questions? I would ask questions for patients undergoing chemotherapy. Do you offer a scalp cooling device to help to prevent hair loss during chemotherapy? I would, I think, questions in terms of vaccination status. What vaccination should I be updated on? I would also ask about ancillary resources at your oncology center, including, dietitian, physical therapy, rehab, and so forth. I would say that if you are someone seeking integrative therapy, in the area of integrative alternative therapy, ask if this team is available at your cancer center, as opposed to going somewhere else in the community. That way, if there's an integrative therapist, such as we have at our center, they can work directly with the oncologist to make sure that integrative therapies are not interacting with the standard treatment. Ask about clinical trials. In big, bold letters, always ask about clinical trials. Do you have a trial that would benefit me at this time? Can I have studies done closer to home? Do I have to drive 45 minutes to have a CT scan to the center where I receive my chemotherapy if I can have it, 10 minutes away? I would ask about, obviously have a number to call in case you were to have any problems, during your chemotherapy. And then even at the beginning, I would say, do I need a vascular access device? Am I going to benefit from having a port catheter? And so, and then I think in terms of just the next topic I was asked to comment on, guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine, including, technology, prepared list of questions, quality of life concerns, discussion of open notes. Again, covered at San Antonio. I would say that, important questions, where should I conduct this visit? Can I do it from my car? Can I do it from home? Who would be accompanying me? Should I have family involved? Ask about in-state versus out-of-state policy. So, as of now, centers are somewhat restricted in terms of offering telehealth if it is an out-of-state patient. And then I would also just make sure you have a reliable device, test the audio and video before. And then I would ask about, what are expectations for follow-up? If I have, a telehealth consultation, am I going to follow up with you? Will you keep following me? Or is this really, a kind of a one-time consultation and I will remain with my current continuity oncologist? Always have your prepared list of questions, of course, and make sure that the televideo is comparable to be an in-office visit. I will sometimes have patients who will say, can you look at this rash? Can you look at this? And, obviously, the patient needs to be in the office for that. And then quality of life concerns, I think it just helps to be at home, surrounded by family a lot of times. There, that way, you really do get your kind of quality of life questions that come to mind and can be answered, and others can weigh in. And I was asked regarding Open Notes, and Open Notes is really, it's a movement. It's started at Brigham Women's that, looked at, really allowing for transparency of electronic health records. I think overall it's a good thing. There are studies that show it's an overall good thing. I think that it just has to be, tempered with respect to patient anxiety that, when they get online and they might see a scan that's been released before they had a chance to discuss it with their provider. We just have to prepare patients for that. But I think that, it does help in the long run to effectively, make the most out of our patient visits when they've had a chance to, review everything up front and formulate their questions ahead of time. So with that, I will return to you, Dr. Messner, and thank you for allowing me to comment on this year's meeting.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Smith. That was just a wonderful presentation. Stellar in every way, very comprehensive. And I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Ms. Cassie Smith. And Ms. Smith is the Breast and Gynecologic Cancer Program Coordinator at Cancer Care. She is a master's degree in social work. She is an oncology social worker. And she'll be discussing Cancer Care's free programs and services and Cancer Care's Hope Line and our website as well. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Spector.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. As mentioned, my name is Cassie Spector. I'm the Breast and Gynecological Cancers Program Coordinator, as well as an oncology social worker at Cancer Care. My role includes working with individuals diagnosed with breast and gynecological cancers and their families, as well as developing programs and initiatives for Cancer Care's Breast and Gynecological Cancers Program. I'll be speaking about Cancer Care's programs and services. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling, support groups, educational workshops, publications, and possible limited financial assistance. There are many aspects of a breast cancer diagnosis that can be addressed through psychosocial supportive services. Making informed treatment decisions, quality of life concerns, clinical trials, fertility options, and communication with one's medical team are important topics that can be discussed with an oncology social worker. A cancer diagnosis can be very overwhelming. Additional support and guidance, as well as establishing a supportive network, may help relieve feelings of anxiety related to one's diagnosis. It can be beneficial to determine ways to approach these challenges that may surface. Working one-on-one with an oncology social worker through individual counseling can offer a space to express one's feelings, emotions, and concerns. By calling Cancer Care's Hope Line, one of our oncology social workers can help navigate ways to seek supportive services. Individuals with a breast cancer diagnosis may also choose to supplement existing social networks by joining a support group. Joining a support group can be a way of connecting with others going through a similar experience who may understand what you're experiencing in terms of the diagnosis and treatment. Being a member in a support group can offer the opportunity to communicate with others, gather and provide support, as well as obtain information. Cancer Care offers national breast cancer support groups online for those in active treatment as well as post-treatment. Our online support groups take place using a password-protected message board format and are led by oncology social workers. Groups are held for 15 weeks at a time, and you can register on Cancer Care's website, cancercare.org. On the website, there is a wide array of reading material and information related to breast cancer. This includes recorded Connect education workshops like today's, Cancer Care's podcast, Cancer Out Loud, the Cancer Care podcast, publications about speaking to your medical team and coping with one's breast cancer diagnosis, as well as stories of help and hope and breast cancer resources. There's also a list of upcoming community programs. People diagnosed with breast cancer may also experience practical and financial concerns through one's treatment. Unfortunately, financial concerns may be a source of continuing stress. Please know if you're encountering financial hardships, there are organizations that may be able to help. Cancer Care offers resource navigation sessions, which is a short-term, strength-based approach to help patients and caregivers nationally. A trained specialist will work with the client in connecting them with resources, referrals, and financial assistance. If you're interested in learning more and connecting to Cancer Care services, I encourage you to call Cancer Care's National Hopeline at 800-813-4673 to speak with one of our oncology social workers. Our oncology social workers can share additional information about our services and can help you explore ways to connect with others, including our support groups and financial assistance resources. It's been a pleasure to be part of this very informative program. Thank you so much, and I'll turn it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Spector. That was just a wonderful presentation and just wonderful resources that you provided our participants. And now I'm going to ask Rob to explain to the participants how to queue up and ask questions online.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And I want to just remind everyone that next week, part two of this program is taking place next week on Wednesday, February 5th from 1 to 2 p.m. It's a little different time than usual, so I just want to remind you of that. It's updates on the treatment of estrogen receptor positive, progesterone receptor positive, and HER2 positive breast cancer from the 47th Annual San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. And now we have a number of questions coming up, and this is the first question. Why, and this I'm going to ask Dr. Hussain, why is the PD-L1 not tested for stage 1 to 3 before receiving Keytruda? Yet if a patient is metastatic, the PD-L1 must be positive to receive Keytruda. Given the potentially serious side effects of immunotherapy, it seems like it should be tested. Dr. Hussain?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and it's not something that is clearly ironed out right now in the practice, but we have to rely on the results of what the clinical trial that led to the FDA approval showed. And there is a lot of difference between someone who has an early stage cancer in terms of the stroma of the cancer itself in comparison to somebody who is metastatic. So it's a different milieu inside the body. In the trial that led to the approval of the addition of immunotherapy to chemotherapy for metastatic first-line triple-negative breast cancer, they did measure the degree of positivity of PD-L1 and correlated that with whether there is a benefit or not, and that is why we ended up with this cutoff from the 22C3 assay of 10 or more on PD-L1 testing. While in the early stage trial, the KEYNOTE-522, we did not see such a difference. So really, that is why it is being offered to the high-risk stage 2 and stage 3 patients, all comers without any need for positivity on PD-L1 testing.
Thank you so much. And for Dr. Smith, what are the guidelines for imaging using MRI with contrast in monitoring a triple negative patient? Should she get one annually until 5 years?
That's a very good question. For a triple negative breast cancer patient, I think the guidelines with respect to MRI in an early stage breast cancer that's triple negative has a lot to do with the surgery that the patient received, a lumpectomy versus mastectomy, and has a lot to do with other factors such as breast density that may obscure the efficacy, the ability for the radiologist to interpret the mammogram. So I think the short answer is there's no single set of guidelines in terms of directing MR imaging for an early stage triple negative breast cancer. I think that there are some considerations. If a patient, for instance, has a triple negative breast cancer and she's a BRCA1 carrier, guidelines would support her undergoing an MRI alternating with mammogram if she were to have opted against a risk reduction, bilateral mastectomy, as an example. But I think getting back to just the general population, it really has to do with the surgery the patient underwent, as well as other factors with regard to the efficacy of utilizing mammography alone.
Excellent, thank you. And for Dr. Hussain, does anyone have any recommendations for someone who might still want to have the option to build a family?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question again?
Does anyone have any recommendations for someone who might still want to have the option to build a family?
Yes, that is a very important question, and it becomes especially relevant in our early stage breast cancer patients that are still premenopausal and will proceed with chemotherapy or treatment, usually before surgery in the neoadjuvant setting. And that impacts the ability of the ovarian tissue to continue to stay viable and be ready to help a woman get pregnant in the future or not. And that is why we always make time for that discussion of whether fertility preservation is desired in any case proceeding with chemotherapy or not. And if that is the case, the patient is being referred to a fertility specialist to help preserve fertility through different modalities, whether they can preserve the ova or the oocyte, and that is typically done before chemotherapy is completed.
Thank you so much. A patient question from a participant. My grandmother, mother, and sister had breast cancer spread, and I was diagnosed with DCIS left breast. Now, this would be a question for Dr. Smith. My grandmother, mother, and sister had breast cancers which spread. I was diagnosed DCIS left breast and lesion, right breast lesion. When I did the blood test multi-cancer panel and BRC1 and BRC2, the results came back uncertain significance. Why didn't any gene results show? The patient is 61 years old.
Yes, thank you for that question. I will still say that we see frequently patients who have a family history, what we call a very kind of significant family history. Odds are still likely that they will not test for a germline mutation. The majority of breast cancers we see are sporadic breast cancers, and so it typically does not come as a surprise. That does not necessarily mean that there's not a hereditary component. It does, however, mean that we just haven't identified what that gene mutation is. I still think that the patient in this type of setting benefits from undergoing an overall an evaluation for high risk. We accommodate that at our centers, and they oftentimes will be referred to a breast surgeon. Obviously, she's already seen one, and a discussion can be had about, what the best next steps forward would be. CIS stage zero breast cancer, we sometimes recommend tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor. You know, again, that's a common recommendation in the setting of CCIS. So there are ways that we can risk mitigate for the individual patient, but at the end, it doesn't come as a surprise when a patient does have a significant family history, but and we don't see a germline mutation. Thanks so much.
Thank you. And now I really want to thank our speakers, and I want to just comment about how wonderful this program has been. Both the speakers and participants. I'm going to ask our speakers to provide a takeaway. I'm going to ask Dr. Hussain if he could start with a takeaway for today's program.
A lot, really, and it's really hard to sum it all up in a sentence or two, but when you look at the direction we're moving, you'll see that we are offering more and more patients neoadjuvant or preoperative therapy, and that is for a good reason. We want to know how can we tailor their adjuvant or postoperative treatment accordingly and hopefully improve their overall prognosis and decrease risk of future recurrence of cancer. One thing that's really important is we saw a lot of major trials in this conference that are looking at de-escalating local therapies like radiation therapy and others that are looking at sparing patient surgery in folks that are responding in an exceptional manner to their neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And overall, I think we're getting better at identifying more targets, more mutations, either on the tumor or through genetic testing, along with certain biomarkers, which hopefully would help us tailor our treatment for every patient and hopefully provide the most benefit while keeping side effects to the minimum. So the last word I'm going to say, I like the question about the person who asked about immunotherapy in addition to chemotherapy for every patient in early stage high risk. I do share their concern, and I know that there is quite a big deal of side effects that can come from that manner. But I think this is the correct way of doing it, to de-escalate it based on which patient we're treating. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hussain. It's wonderful. And Dr. Smith.
Thank you for allowing me to speak today. I think this has been an interesting San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. I think the takeaway messaging has been to kind of challenge conventional wisdom in that we can basically alter the sequence in which we give patients therapy, both endocrine therapy as well as targeted therapy. Sorry, I have an emergency Amber Alert. Let me see if I can silence this. I apologize for that. And, you know, I mean, for instance, there was the PADMA trial, which I mentioned, which really looks at endocrine therapy, CDK4/6 inhibitor compared to chemotherapy. So here, therapy in the first-line setting. There's the DESTINY-Breast06 trial that really showed that for patients who are HER2-negative but are HER2-low or HER2-ultra-low can benefit from this antibody drug conjugate drug that before had only been reserved for HER2-positive breast cancer patients. So I will just say that it's just important to, you know, ask your oncologist these questions. Are there alternatives? Are there other lines of hormone endocrine therapy in combination that might be an option for me right now? And prepare your questions ahead of time. But I think overall, a very informative conference, and a lot to take away. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Smith. And Ms. Spector?
Thank you, and it's been a great program. And so I think that my takeaway would be just knowing that you're not alone, knowing that there's support available, whether you're looking for emotional support, whether it's a support group or counseling, or you're looking to speak with someone who's been through a similar experience, or you're looking for financial support, know that there's organizations there to assist you, to reach out to your treatment team, see how they can connect you with the resources they have, and then being able to reach out to organizations like Cancer Care who may also be able to provide support. So really just know that you're not alone and there's many resources available for you.
Thank you. Thank you. And this has been an amazing program. Although we've done this program before, I have to say that both the speakers and the participants asked really great questions. The speakers, of course, answered those questions phenomenally. However, there are so many of you on the call today that we were not able to take all of your questions, so I do want to comment on that. For those of you who had the opportunity to ask a question, we still recommend that you go back to treating healthcare team and speak to them about, you know, ask them the question because they know you the best. They have all your records in front of them, and they're basically able to really answer your questions in the best way possible. And for those of you who didn't get to ask a question, please take your question also to the healthcare team because, again, they know you the best, and they know, you know, they have the records right in front of you. They've seen you. They've known you over time. And ask your question of them as well. And also, your healthcare team is your best resource, of course, to start with in asking questions. So as you come up with other questions, be sure to ask your team. Ask them over and over again until you understand you've learned a lot today. So when you ask your question, you'll be more informed as you ask your question. Also, I do want to remind all of you that I think that one thing that's really people often find hard is that it's hard to during the day, it's possible to reach a physician or a member of your healthcare team. But evenings, weekends, and holidays are often a very difficult time to reach your healthcare team. And so always ask your healthcare team, what is the number to call evenings, weekends, and holidays? Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. You've been a phenomenal group, really very, very well-informed questions that you asked, and really an excellent answers from our speakers. And I hope you've learned a lot. And again, I want to thank you all for your participation. I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.